Good morning. Happy Wednesday. We're joined in the studio, as we usually are at this moment in time, by the mayor of New Bedford, John Mitchell. Good morning, Mayor. How are you, sir?
Doing all right, Chris. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Thank you for asking. We are getting closer to Christmas. Big, big event down there at Brown University. You're a mayor of a city. You know the mayor of Providence quite well. Your daughter went to Brown University. Talk about that a little bit.
Well, the overriding reaction is it is just awful. These two kids who are about the same age as my kids, getting mowed down in a classroom, studying for finals. One of them wasn't even studying for finals; he was just there with his friends, hanging out in a study session, planning to go out with them later. So he just happened by. Just people with two kids with their whole lives in front of them,
right.
and just a shame. And I think it was lucky that, given how many rounds went off, that there weren't other kids killed.
Yes, I agree.
There, and it sounds like the other ones who were hit are going to recover. Thank God for that. But obviously, so much has been said about mass shootings in America and why it happens here and how we try to get our arms around it. It's hard to explain. Yeah, some of it is just the existence of guns in our society that's different from everywhere else in the world, and some of it, but that's not all of it. And it's complex, and some of it has to do with the availability of mental health treatment in this country, because you got to be crazy to do something like that, plain English. There's all that. There's a lot else to be said there too. And we in New Bedford, I'll just note, sent some assistance over, sent a couple of officers who are on the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms Task Force. So they went over because of that connection. They went over and pitched in, and they may still be over there. You know, I texted Mayor Smiley in the middle of it, who he's doing a very good job. He's remaining calm. He's being very logical and methodical about the response, and compassionate, and very present. He can't help it. He lives almost like a block away from where it happened.
Right.
So I'm friendly with him. I texted him. I said, whatever you need. I said, I offered up the ambulances in the middle of it. I'm watching it play out on TV. They turned out, because they pre-positioned a number of ambulances over there, not knowing whether the guy was still around. So they had, so we said we'd send some over. They weren't needed. The thing I also sent him to, and he might have been aware of it, because he just responded back, thanks. But what I sent him was this, what is essentially a playbook for mayors when there's an active shooter in their city. Yeah, the U.S. Conference of Mayors and a couple of other organizations prepared it a few years ago, which is the fact that it exists is a sad commentary on American society right now.
Yep.
But yeah, there's a roadmap that we have in our office. This is what happened. I mean, we do training for it in City Hall, but you can't train for every conceivable scenario like this. Like, nobody, they weren't training for this over at Brown, or maybe not in the same way, some of the office buildings over there, but not with students and study halls and stuff. You wouldn't expect them to train for that. So, but mayors do have this playbook out there, and it's because these things are happening these things have happened a lot, really, since Columbine in 1999. America's had this disease of mass shootings, and we haven't kicked it yet. So, as I think about it, as I mentioned to you, I appreciate your text. You weren't aware my daughter Natalie had graduated in the spring, but she was there up until recently, and made it all feel a little more closer to home as well. So I feel so badly for those parents, and you have your dreams bound up in your kids, and to see something like that happen, and never mind the victims themselves or their whole lives ahead of them. One of the things that The other sort of set of comments I have is sort of in the way of a law enforcement set of comments. One is they've got to be very frustrated that they have not caught the guy.
Yeah.
And I think they were appropriate in running to ground the lead that they had at that hotel in Coventry. They had a guy who had, you know, was checked in late and had had a number of weapons, and so they took a good look at him, but they didn't release his name. Somebody leaked it, and yeah. There were a couple of news organizations that took it and ran with it and speculated about it. I watched CNN. I'm like listening to the commentary on CNN. I feel like nobody's confirmed that this guy was it. They had guests on, and they were commenting about the guy. I'm like, well, time out.
Terrible.
So it turned out it wasn't that kid that they named on CNN was not the guy. So I thought that was kind of irresponsible. But that aside, and they made it, I'm sure there are other outlets that did it as well. But they did the right thing in walking away from that guy. They had a number much in the way of law enforcement resources running down that lead, and they put themselves in a position to understand whether that the guy in the hotel could have done it. And I'm sure they came to the right conclusion. But now they've got somebody at large. I suspect he's nowhere near Brown University at this point, but there still has to be a big police presence to calm people over there. And so now you have a fugitive situation. And I've done, as you know, I've been involved in fugitive investigations, and they tend to they tend to go in phases. But when you don't know who the person is, that is the single most important thing. Figure out who the guy is. And so how do you figure it out? Well, certainly they didn't have good camera coverage.
Right.
It's like they didn't have good camera. That's not fair. What they didn't, they, this guy so happened to slip between the cracks mm-hmm. and the camera coverage. They had plenty of cameras over there. It just so happened that the cameras can't catch everything.
Right.
You can't cover everything. You can't put a camera in every nook and cranny in an urban environment, or even indoors, right? There's always going to be some gaps, and this guy walked through the gaps, was caught on camera in a couple of places. He was walking around with a mask, with a surgical mask. You still see people out on the street.
You do.
Even 5 years out from the pandemic, wearing masks, so that wasn't crazy. It was winter time, so he's got a hat on. He's wearing black, but yeah, people wear black. And as we were discussing off air, like east side of Providence is a pretty funky place. Yeah. Like someone who kind of looks a little odd is not necessarily going to stand out over
there.
They
fit
right?
in.
It's like,
right.
you know, it's a college. It's a
you and I look odd over there.
Yeah, we look odd. Right. Look the way that straight laced guy. He must be up to something, right?
Right.
So I think there is that element as well. Fugitive investigations tend to go in phases, right? These phases might go differently when the identity of the person you're looking for isn't yet established, but they tend to go in phase. Like the first phase is just like scurrying around trying to track, keep up on the trail. Mm-hmm. And then what happens a lot of times when somebody splits and they don't immediately catch the person is that they will start to look for places where that person might go. They will also do electronic surveillance. They'll ping the phone. They try to triangulate the location. That's what the Marshal Service tends to do. They're the ones who specialize in fugitive investigations. Although all the state law, we don't really do it locally, but the state police in Massachusetts and other states, as well as all the federal agencies, do some fugitive investigating. But it's really the U.S. Marshals that specialize in it. And then if somebody's gone for a long time, if the phone pinging isn't working because they've picked up burner phones or they've sort of reestablished themselves elsewhere, then that's when you start to backtrack toward families and wait for outreach and look at bank accounts and things like that. So like in the cases of like Whitey Bulger and Osama bin Laden, these people were gone for years and reestablished themselves elsewhere, then you just have to find connections, right, and go where they might focus on those places where they're likeliest to be. This probably won't get to that point. They just have to figure out who this guy is. So they're probably lifting DNA evidence off of some of the shell casings or anything else he left behind and see if this DNA matches anybody that's already in the system. They might subpoena some of the likes of like 23andMe and Ancestry.com. That's a big thing these days in law enforcement to see if there's any matches with relatives so you can work backwards that way. And then, of course, talking to eyewitnesses and look at every conceivable camera. They got to figure out who this dude is. And what's interesting is, you know, you can imagine there's, and this is beyond where, certainly my understanding, this is far beyond where I was when we were working on fugitive investigations, including Bulger, was, you know, the role of artificial intelligence. So, like, you get an image of a guy, digital image of a guy looking like the guy we're looking at on the TV, and here walking down the street, and there may be a way of identifying him just by his the figure he cuts, right? He's, you know, a certain height, arms a certain length, and it's almost sort of taking facial recognition to the next step.
The right? Gait, it's the way they walk?
Yeah, all that, just to see if there are any images of him elsewhere, like walking into a bed. Like, so this is, if that data is out there, there may end up being a match, but that's really heavy AI stuff, and whether that data is out there somewhere for them to get a match is, it's pretty high-tech stuff, but it's not inconceivable they're going to identify him that way as well, or at least develop a lead that way.
Speaking with the mayor of New Bedford, he's here
anyway,
every Wednesday.
So I have a lot to say about this.
No, I find it fascinating, Mayor, because we are, it's the biggest story in the world, and it's right down 195. It is, you know, I told you, they sent in all kinds of media to Providence, and sometimes that's better, sometimes it's certainly worse, but you're obviously a unique guy in the fact that you're a mayor, but also have federal law enforcement experience, so I think we're all enlightened by your experiences here. Were you shocked at the fact that they were able to have no video of the actual crime?
I think that's just a matter of luck. I mean, this guy probably thought through it. You could tell he left the place and wasn't acting in a way that would have drawn people's attention. He was just sort of briskly walking down the street. And so I'm sure he thought about that and what the implications would be if he was running. And it obviously dressed in a way that meant not to draw attention to himself.
Right.
But it's hard. There are cameras. Cameras have proliferated in our world greatly, and we have them certainly on our cell phones. But he probably wasn't in the room long enough for anybody to turn around and start taking photos. He was in and out.
And when they're throwing lead at you, when they're firing a gun at you, it's very difficult to take that picture.
It is. Witness the, you know, the distinction between that shooting and the one that took place on Bondi Beach in Sydney, right? There were plenty of people who were distant enough who were taking cover such that they could take a video of the shooters, and there was lots of video there. It was going on for several minutes. This was probably just in and out. So no cameras, so very few in the way. They've not at least published any handheld video at all. And then as far as the fixed camera videos, it just doesn't look like they just had a good shot at him anywhere.
We're speaking with Mayor John Mitchell. Mayor, you're in federal law enforcement. Help me out here. They obviously have information they're not sharing with us. What's the theory behind that?
Well, so there's a balance to be struck and judgment to be exercised as between two competing concerns. One is they want the public's, that on one hand you'd like under these circumstances that are urgent, you got to get the guy. You don't know what he is. You don't know what he's capable of, especially if he's cornered. So you want to enlist the public's assistance in identifying the guy and understanding where he might be. So against the possibility that by releasing certain information, it might give the bad guy a sense of what evidence people have captured, right? Mm-hmm. And for instance, if they capture an image of somebody with, like, you know, a full head of hair, he might just say, "Well, I'm just going to shave my head," right?
Right.
That's a benign example. In many cases, it's much more. It could be much more ominous, right? There could be a risk of not just destruction of evidence, but also the intimidation or worse of witnesses, right? So in this case, this guy, if he knows there's a particular, let's just say hypothetically, it's hard, we can speculate about what evidence they're not coming forward with, but hypothetically, if they knew that there was one person who that the bad guy knew, if there's one person who laid eyes on him, could give a description,
right?
You know, he might take action. So I doubt that's probably the case now, because this guy's probably way the hell away from Providence at this point. But that's just, these are the kinds of judgment calls that law enforcement has to make in circumstances like this.
We have the mayor of New Bedford. Of course, long before this, he was a federal prosecutor. Mayor, you had that situation with Bulger, where I believe, anyway, that some of the concerns were that he would get rid of Greg, the woman that was with him, that he'd dump her, literally, to avoid getting captured.
Yeah, well, I'll give you an example from Bulger. One of the things that we knew about was he had a bank account in, let's see, we had a few different bank accounts overseas, one in Montreal, one in London, one in Dublin. And it was, I'm trying to remember which one. It was either Dublin or London is the one that the statements were going back to his house in South Boston. And so we didn't do anything with that. We made sure that that never saw the light of day. We didn't talk about it. And we just watched it.
Right.
And to see if there was any withdrawals or anything like that. But, you know, he was smarter than the average, right? So he knew that, like, just like those things would have been burnt because there had been certain people he knew or presumed that the FBI had already talked to, who
right.
Told us about the bank account. And so he didn't lay a hand on it. So he had some bank accounts that had tens of thousands of dollars in them, and he didn't touch them. So, but it's stuff like that.
Yeah.
That's probably more one of many things that we just didn't reveal, because you didn't want to tip people off, and we didn't know where he was, right? And didn't know what he was paying attention to. So you don't want to take the risk that, that you know, we reveal something that ends up burning us.
Mayor, we'll be keeping up with the story, obviously. Hopefully it's going to come to a conclusion during this segment, but I don't know.
Yeah, I'll just say this as a wrap-up comment. Look, it's an awful thing.
Mm-hmm.
We in New Bedford trained for this. I can't say that what we hope for in the training is to mitigate loss. It is hard to prevent this stuff from happening. If you have a lone person who's armed, and you can get a lot of different types of powerful firearms without too much trouble in America, it's hard to prevent it entirely. And the training that we do is both in the way of helping people avoid it, getting hit, and to harden certain facilities, and again, to make it harder, and also to take steps that we think can also attend to, like, people who are wounded quickly. We've had those exercises, but also to catch the guy afterward. But again, it's really hard to do in a free society.
We're going to take a break, Mayor, and then we'll come back. Stick around. We have the mayor of New Bedford here. We'll have him for the hour. If you'd like to ask him a question, you can. It's 508-996-0500. Stick around. We'll be right back.
This portion of programming on WBSM is brought to you by D's Hot Dogs in New Bedford, where you can get two hot dogs, soda, and a bag of chips for only $5.
South Coast Now with Chris McCarthy, weekdays on 1420 AM and 99.5 FM. WBSM.
And all the kids at school, they were wishing they were me that night. And now I'm on. It never felt so good, it never felt so right. And we're glowing like the metal on the edge of a knife. Glowing like the metal on the edge of a knife. Come on, hold on tight. Well, come on, hold on tight.
Welcome back to the program. Little Meatloaf off the mayor's playlist. Mayor.
Chris, to share with everybody, that is a great song.
It really
is. Took me so long to put that on the mayor's playlist?
I mean, really, you forget about that song.
Yeah.
It's such a classic. Mayor, you recently passed out $500,000 in grants to local organizations to battle the opioid crisis in the region. Where did that funding come from?
It came from the opioid settlements. So the ones that we participated in directly, cases that we participated in directly, as well as the money that the state landed. And it is we're getting a fair amount of money to give out to organizations to support their efforts. I am almost a little reluctant to say this, but we've made progress in the last couple of years. The both the non-fatal and fatal overdoses are down pretty significantly here. They're down elsewhere too. They're just down generally. I think we are known. I'm confident saying that we're known pretty far and wide as doing a very good job. We've been recognized by the National League of Cities and others as being effective at dealing with the opioid epidemic here. And because we take a coordinated approach to something we created 10 years ago now, the Greater New Bedford Opioid Task Force, which coordinates both law enforcement as well as treatment as well as educational initiatives. It's comprised of chaired by our board of our director of health, Stephanie Sloan, as well as the chief of police. But it's we've got more money now to help people. Some of the problem we have, frankly, in New Bedford is imported into New Bedford. It's not all sort of native. The problem isn't native here as much as the numbers would reflect. There are a number of folks who come here for housing and services and such.
They bring it with them.
Yeah, there's a little bit of that, which is a broader, more complex problem to deal with, but one that I think just people need to know. It's also hard to get numbers on that too, but we know that that's part of it. But it's not all. There are plenty of people around here who are from here who are suffering from substance abuse, and so we want. We take care of people. Like someone's in dire need, we take care of them, but we also want to make sure that we're doing everything we can so that future generations are not succumbing to it as well. So education in our schools about the risks of opioid abuse is really important, as well as the law enforcement angle. We want to be effective at, especially work with, not only interdicting it at the local level, but working with state and federal law enforcement agencies to disrupt the trafficking of fentanyl in particular. And I think we do a good job in it, but it's as people know, like we all know somebody who's around here. Unfortunately, just about everybody knows somebody who's succumbed, and it's a tough thing. It's happened to lots and lots of families, and we're committed to the work. It's very important. We really want to turn the tide.
We have the mayor of New Bedford here, John Mitchell, in the studio. The chief of police appeared last night in front of the appointments and briefings committee, city council. I heard him. I thought he did an excellent job. I would expect that. He was talking, one of the questions from the city council was about the interdiction of dirt bikes and scooters and ATVs that were rampaging all over the streets. We talked about it the other day, but your thoughts on that. And he was talking about bringing in the state police, the helicopters, the multi-agencies, because it's just they're a real pain in the ass.
Yeah.
Right?
No doubt about it. Those ATVs are a real pain, and we've seen
them. And some of them are adults. They're not kids.
We've arrested some kids who are in their 30s.
On those
bikes. So of course that some of them are adults and they should know better. It's not like 13-year-olds and 14-year-olds doing it. So some of that, but it's not nearly all of it. So yeah, look, I think that's an important quality of life challenge in the city. It's not unique to New Bedford. There are lots of other cities that are experiencing it. And the chief recognizes the importance of dealing with it as best the police department can. It is hard for the police department to keep up with them, to go into the places that dirt bikes can go, unregistered dirt bikes can go, which includes in people's backyards and down alleys and just in places where it's hard to get a police cruiser to continue the chase, and dangerous to continue the chase to pedestrians and others. One of the ways that we've been able to become a little more effective at it is to bring in the state police, which has other assets, especially helicopters. And that's been proven to be, in the times when we've worked with them, an effective means of doing it. That's not a full solution, just because it's not like we can get the state police helicopter every weekend in the summer to cruise around and look for these guys, right? There's only so much of that resource to go around the state. What I'd say is this, a couple things. What will make it, and I just remind people, what makes it easier, if you know where these things are garaged, to let us know. That's one thing. The other thing I'll just say to you is, say to everybody is, and we've talked about it before, it bears reemphasizing that there is a bill in the state legislature that would make it easier to seize and destroy these vehicles. The chief Chief Thody was the chief in Hartford, Connecticut, where right. once they seized these vehicles, the state law allowed them to destroy them.
Yep.
But Massachusetts doesn't allow that.
Of course.
Rhode Island allows it. So Rhode Island, Connecticut, yes, not Massachusetts. So there is a bill, as I understand it, pending in the legislature right now, that would give us increased authority to seize those vehicles and destroy them. I'd like to do that, and I'd like to find some grandmother out there somewhere can, as I said, my dream is to see a grandmother in a steamroller.
Right.
Right. Just, or like a Wile E. Coyote yeah. plunger and blow them up or something, right. something like that.
Right? Yeah.
If we can put that and make it viral just so everybody can see what happens if you drive those things around.
Mayor, there was one piece of, it was new information to me that the chief of police put out last night during his hearing in the appointment and briefings committee. I didn't realize, according to the chief, some people trailer the vehicles to the city of New Bedford to ride them around the city of
New
Bedford.
Yeah, I hadn't heard that, but it doesn't surprise me. It wouldn't surprise me at all. This is a multi-state problem. It's largely in the Northeast, but it's all over the place. And, some states have better tools to deal with it. And so because of that, in part, I think it could see us being more vulnerable to that kind of behavior. But
yeah.
Yeah, that wouldn't surprise me at all that they're not all local.
Mayor, before we go to the other topics, in the conversation with the motorcycles and things like that, and obviously the using the helicopters, anything you're coming away from Providence with for updating our technology here, law enforcement technology? Have you learned? Is it too early to make judgments now, or are you seeing gaps maybe that? In your mind, I know you think you're seeing this, and you're thinking,
"Yeah,
how does it reflect?"
It's funny you mentioned that. I did have a conversation with Chief Thody that night as it was unfolding. Saturday night, I said, we talked about making sure that we have the benefit of any after action reports they do. I passed that along to him. He said he's already on it. He said by having, as I mentioned at the outset of the show, that we sent over a couple of officers who are part of an ATF task force, and by being on that task force, they're actually going to be they'll have the opportunity to be briefed in on some of that stuff. So, we certainly want to learn from it. Again, the goal here is to understand how we can mitigate loss and deter that kind of behavior, but it's impossible to stop entirely.
Mayor, the city has you proposed zoning changes to parking minimums that are moving the city in the full council. It's going to go to the full council. I had one of the developers, a property owner, Jay Lanigan, in yesterday
yep.
to talk about it because he supports your changes. Talk about that.
Well, Jay was there last night, as I understand it, or the night before.
Night before,
yeah. Two nights ago now. Yeah, today's Wednesday. Yeah, so Jay articulates it very well. It's basically if you build a building and you're required to put in a certain number of spaces, you the developer don't get any more money for those spaces, mm-hmm. for that real estate, and it just it takes up more space. So that means space that could be used to build more apartments, right?
Yes.
In theory. So when you have a rule that requires a large number of minimum parking spaces, as we do here, two spaces to an apartment, to a unit, that's a lot of parking spaces. So by reducing it, so what this proposed and what the city council thankfully adopted was a reduction from, as we proposed, from two required spaces to one. Mm-hmm. So that should help developers. It means they can construct the same thing on less land, right? The same footprint of an apartment building on less land that they have to buy, less land that is consumed and is effectively foreclosed from development by other developers. Mm-hmm. And we're doing it only in the multifamily neighborhood. So none of this affects the single family neighborhoods right. in the city. So, yeah, so I know a lot of people, and certainly I do too, want to preserve single family arrangements in the city as they are right now. And this doesn't touch it, but it does allow for more apartment buildings in places where mm-hmm. we think it makes some sense.
Yeah, Jay, when he spent an hour with us yesterday giving us his wisdom, his experience, and talking about how maybe changing these parking is really going to have major unlocking of development in the city.
Yeah, it could. I think it's going to help. We're trying to remove barriers to development, where some of it is, you know, we're looking at some of the streamlining permitting. We're always working on, like, pulling out things that slow up permitting or ask too much. We've got some more things that I think we'll be able to announce in the next couple of months on that front. Another thing that is before the council, I think the council is going to take it up in February, is a proposal to change the minimum lot sizes in the city, right? So if people wonder, especially in the tenement neighborhoods, whether you see these, what planners call missing teeth in the neighborhood, right? So where a house stood, there's a vacant lot. Mm-hmm. And so people wonder, well, why? How come nobody built a house there? Well, some of it is the economics of doing so. But even then, some of it is just the fact that the city has in place a zoning rule that requires a larger lot to build any house, right? So I always forget the number. It's like 6,000 or 8,000 square feet. It's 8,000 square feet or 6. I'm not going to get it wrong. But basically, the lots you see that are missing teeth don't satisfy that minimum requirement. And so they cannot be built there. And so what we're doing is we want to lower the minimum lot size right. in the city, at least in those neighborhoods, so that people can start to fill in those gaps.
We're the mayor.
I'm sorry. I should have the number on the tip of my tongue, but I don't.
We can look it up during the break.
We can. Somebody's going to text me. Somebody's listening. To everybody in City Hall, it'll be a contest.
Whoever gets here first.
Yes.
We'll take a break, Mayor. We come back. We have people on hold who want to speak with the mayor of New Bedford. We'll be right back. Plenty to talk about when we come back.
Back to Chris McCarthy and South Coast Now on WBSM. Call
508-996-0500. Welcome back to the program. Little Nirvana off the mayor's playlist. We have the mayor of New Bedford here. Mayor, we're going to go to the phones.
Let's go to the phones.
Let's go to the phones. We got people waiting on hold. Good morning. Thank you for waiting.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. Hi, Mr. Mayor.
Hey.
Hey, I just wanted to follow up to see if you have an update on the replacement of the carriage post light at the Brookline Park Duck Pond Island.
Yes. Yeah, so what's the question? When's it going to happen?
Pretty much. What's the update? It's still
yeah.
The still
update
being
is
broken.
They are going to, once they get the parts, they're going to put them in. This is an issue that we have across the city. So you will see across the city, and this is a fair question, that we have street lights that are down. And we put in their place some kind of marker. Sometimes it's an orange barrel, which I'm not crazy about. But we have a problem because we have an electrician on staff, but he just came on staff recently, and he's attending to other stuff. Bottom line, we're having a hell of a time hiring people like electricians and plumbers these days.
You can't compete.
So we actually have the street lights in. So same goes for over there at over at Brooklawn.
Yeah.
So it is on DPI's radar screen, and they'll make it happen when they can.
Yeah, it'd be hard to compete, I would think, with the private sector for electricians.
It's hard these days. It really is to bring people in-house. And the wages, I mean, we're talking to AFSCME, the AFSCME union, about raising the wages of certain specialized employees like that. And I think we're making some headway on it, but it's bringing in people with a trade background into city government is tough these days. And it's a problem that manifests itself in things like streetlights and the problem that the caller's citing over at Brookline Park.
Mayor, when you came in, I heard money jingling in your pocket. Sounds like you have a surplus of almost $5 million. Talk about that.
There's always, so despite the city council's cuts that they are last year, we were able to manage to within our budget. This is the previous year's cuts. This year, we'll see. We had to do a number of things to get to that number, but $5 million surplus out of $500 million general fund budget, right? It works out to be about 1%. So $5 million seems like a lot of money, but it's actually kind of a close shave for a budget that big. And it's getting a little bit harder, but I appreciate the work that our departments did to try to get it underneath the number that the city council gave us. It's just we're going to that well. In the way of cuts, we're going to the well a lot, and my concern is that this year it's going to be harder to do. I don't expect us to have much of a surplus in the coming year.
I saw Mark Sylvia, state representative, in the picture with you when you were passing out the opioid money. Any promises from him of additional unencumbered state aid?
Well, that's a big issue right now, Chris. So I hope it becomes a big issue. The Mass Municipal Association is at last raising it as an important issue because that is to say that the need for the legislature to come through with state aid in a bigger way. It's bad. As we've said, it just hasn't kept up with the cost of government, and not nearly. If we received in state aid what we received in 2008, adjusted for inflation, we'd be pretty flush with cash right now. We probably have more than $14 million more from the state. We could do a lot of stuff with that, including providing some tax relief as well, but it's just the backing away of the state's backing away from its commitment to provide an adequate amount of state aid, I think, is one of the big contributors to our tight finances and the fact that taxpayers have been put upon in our city.
We'll take a break, then we'll come back. We have more with the mayor of New Bedford, John Mitchell. Stick around. To the program, a little more off the mayor's playlist by the Doobie Brothers. Talk about the schools, the architectural firm that's been selected.
So the punchline is that for the school to be, the next school to be built in the city will be the combination of the Ashley and Swift schools in the North End. The Ashley schools is on Ashley Boulevard, and the Swift School is at the corner of Tarkin Hill Road and Cushionet Avenue, and they're both over 100 years old, and but they're not in bad shape, but it's like they're really the next ones to be replaced. So there's a process that we use that every city and town uses in Massachusetts to get funding from the Mass School Building Authority,
right,
which pays for most of it, but they also have a say in the architect that we pick. So as you know, it's a priority for us that when we build something that it look great. It's really important, and this has been the case for the schools that have been built, but things like the Public Safety Center and the South End, the pedestrian bridge over Route 18. So in this case, the firm that was selected by a committee that included both the MSBA representatives as well as city representatives, was T2 Architects, which is based in New Bedford. And this is, it's good news because they're the ones that designed the Jacobs School, the new Jacobs School in the South End, and won a national award for it. They were, when that school was completed, the next year it won the Industry Journal's new school of the year in the United States.
That's cool.
So that was pretty cool. And so they're the ones also who designed the one that's being built right now in the former Goodyear site, the combined Congdon Duval School. So that's that, and that's people. If you've haven't driven by there, go check it out. It's coming up fast. It's a big elementary school, but it's going to look great. So T2 did that, designed that one, and they're doing this next one in the North End. So that's all good news. It's that the kids are going to have a really first rate facility in the North End, which is what they deserve.
You built a number of schools. You've upgraded the stock.
We've tried to, and when we do that, we have, and when we do that, it's important that we maintain a very high level of design, because those schools are going to be around there for a long time, and having they should look great. And this isn't because we want, for a couple of reasons. One, we want people to come to the city and say, "Yeah, look, there's some cool stuff here." But also, like, look at these buildings, like we all do when we go somewhere and see. You know, things that have been designed well. But the other thing is, we want it to be a source of pride for the city. I mean, and we have lots of really great design schools. I mean, one of the best examples in Massachusetts is Fairhaven High School. People who ask anybody who's graduating from Fairhaven High School, and they have a lot of pride in the fact that they went to high school in that beautiful building.
My dad was always writing checks back to that place.
It is one of the most beautiful schools in the United States, and it has been that way for a long time. And so, I share that sensibility when we build schools, elementary schools, or any public facility, like the pedestrian bridge.
Right.
It's got to look just so. We insist on it. So T2 is a great architectural firm. They happen to be based in downtown New Bedford, and we look forward to their doing yet another great design for this new school in the North End.
Mayor, the shopping season started downtown. Everybody go downtown, go down to Cushion Avenue, all that good stuff, right?
Absolutely. Get there now.
Before the mayor gets there.
Well, if you see me out shopping, you're late.
You're all late. Head to Carter's, by the way. So, Mayor, will we see you next week?
Yeah, you'll see me.
Yeah, we'll be back.